All right, welcome everybody. Thanks for joining me today, the last session of Tech Ed. Has everybody had a great time so far? It's been great? Awesome. Good. It's fun for me. Doing the very last session is a bit of a challenge, but thanks for sticking with me. Thanks for sticking all the way to the end. I appreciate it tremendously. My name is Richard Hicks. I'm a Microsoft MVP. I work for a company called Iron Networks based in the Silicon Valley here in the United States in California. I'm the director of sales engineering, and I'm here to talk to you today about direct access in Windows Server 2012. Technically, this could be Windows Server 2012 R2, because I can tell you there are no changes for direct access in Server 2012. So you've been getting Server 2012 R2'd to death this week. All the new changes are around Hyper-V, networking, virtualization, storage, blah, blah, blah. Direct access remains untouched. So everything we're going to talk about today applies to Windows Server 2012 R2 direct access. Great. So before I get started in digging into the session deep, I want to talk a little bit about some of the challenges that we face with deploying remote access solutions. I've been deploying remote access solutions for, nearly 20 years now. My first server was, I think, an NT4 RRAS server that I had built for us administrators, right? So, and that's largely where remote access kind of started. It grew into something that became vital for us administrators because we didn't want to have to come into the office or the data center in the middle of the night. We wanted to be able to phone in from home. Dial in from home. Later, as we got broadband internet connections, and so did the executives, they wanted to be able to access their data and applications, and so we kind of caved in and gave them access to that. And ultimately, it kind of grew and grew, and pretty soon, remote access becomes ubiquitous. Everybody has remote access. You get your laptop, you got to have remote access. It's just kind of a standard thing. It presents a number of challenges for us, security administrators, and for us, network engineers. From a user or operability perspective, it has some challenges in just, for end users being able to use it. It can be challenging in terms of connectivity, client management. Name resolution is always a challenge for remote access solutions. Also, for the administrators, one of the challenges, and this was a real challenge that I used to face, is that we would prepare our laptops for our field users, and they would be pristine, corporate images, all up to date, all applications installed. We'd give it to that remote guy. They would take it out in the field, and we wouldn't see it for 3 or 4 months. And when it came back, it was thrashed. Somebody had disabled the firewall. So all kinds of problems. Antivirus stopped updating. Windows Update, somebody turned that off. There's all kinds of challenges there. And so we have very little visibility when our remote devices leave our premises, and we can't monitor, manage, and maintain them. Direct access kind of solves a lot of those challenges, both from a user perspective and from an administrator perspective, and that's what I'm going to demonstrate in this session, is kind of show you how this solution addresses both of those kind of primary concerns. So, it's going to make me walk back up here. So the agenda for today's session, again, we're going to start out at a high level, talk about direct access, what it is, what the benefits to deploying direct access are, talk just briefly about what's new in Windows Server 2012 direct access. That's a whole session in itself, so we're going to go real quickly over that. Talk about the components that make up a direct access solution as well. Talk about the limitations of direct access, because it's not for everybody. It doesn't fit in all deployment scenarios. Talk about how it works. Go through a demonstration. I'm actually going to deploy direct access right here on my laptop in a matter of minutes. You'll see how easy it can be. And then I want to follow up and just kind of wrap up with a discussion of the security considerations for direct access. So what is direct access? Direct access is the next generation of remote access. It's really remote access reimagined or redefined. It's a paradigm shift, really. And I'll explain a little bit more later. It is, and it provides, always-on remote access VPN. It's seamless and transparent and provides bi-directional connectivity. And this opens up some new use cases and I think some new deployment scenarios that are interesting to us as security administrators and systems management folks. So we'll talk a little bit about that. fundamentally, I tend not to refer to this solution as a VPN solution, because when you look at traditional, or what I call legacy VPN, you'll see that it differs very much from you know, regular VPN. So when we're talking about regular VPN, or as I'm still calling it, or as I'm starting to call it, legacy VPN, VPNs are a pain. They're a challenge. I mean, they're really tough to use sometimes. They are intrusive. They're invasive. They're user-initiated. And so we rely on the user to have to make their connection back to the corpnet when they need access to applications and data. So the user is sitting on their laptop, and they have to proactively say, okay, I need to get to my home drive. Let's start up the VPN. I'll launch the client, enter my credentials. It fails. I got to enter them again. I got to enter in my dynamic password. And then I get connectivity. If I move, of course, then the VPN connection drops. I lose my saved work sometimes. I have to reinitiate. Frustrating, a lot of pain points around that. But again, the fundamental challenge here is that it is user-operated. It requires proactive input from the user to be able to connect to the network. That doesn't help us as security administrators and systems management folks. Contrast that with direct access, because direct access, as I'd mentioned, is always on, seamless and transparent, doesn't require any action from the user at all. It happens entirely behind the scenes. Fully authenticated, fully encrypted, very secure, but doesn't require that the user do or even know anything. I'm going to show you later how the user accesses their applications and data in exactly the same fashion outside the corporate network as they do inside the corporate network, so it makes it super, super simple for them. So again, when we're talking about the model or the paradigm of direct access, if you think about it in the manner of extending the corporate network to the user, that kind of opens up some new use case possibilities, and I think that you'll start to understand why it's much, much better, much more efficient, certainly, than legacy or traditional VPN. So some of the benefits of direct access. From an end-user perspective, it provides a streamlined user experience and familiar access. Users access their data and their applications in exactly the same way, regardless of where they are. So you don't have to retrain users. If they're using single-label host names to get to your web application servers, they can continue to do so even when they're outside the office. So all of this, of course, leads to increased productivity. Now, from a user perspective, that's all well and fine, but unfortunately, in the reality of projects and financing and so forth and funding for these projects, making things easier for the user doesn't always get our projects funded. But there are some goodness and there's some good things available to us as administrators for this solution as well. For example, from an administrator perspective, the solution's always managed. So your laptops or your mobile devices are always managed. Since direct access is seamless and transparent, as I'd mentioned, since the client is always connected or connected anytime they have an active internet connection, they're always connected to the corpnet. So that means that they have access to your domain controllers. They have access to your Active Directory group policy updates on a regular basis. They have access to your systems management servers. They function outside the wall the same way they do inside the walls. And so when you think about it in that manner, you have much, much more visibility into how your direct access clients are being managed, monitored, and maintained. All of this, of course, results in improved compliance and reduced administration costs. In terms of administration costs, I think one of the big ones is help desk calls. VPN clients can be a real challenge to support. They can be problematic, certainly. Also, with regards to password synchronization challenges you have around legacy and remote access VPN of that fashion, we don't have the password synchronization issues because anytime the user is logging in, Control-Alt-Delete, if they have an active internet connection, they are actually authenticating against a live domain controller on your corporate network. So we don't have those password synchronization challenges where user changes the password on corpnet, goes outside, they're logging on with cache credentials on their laptop, and all of a sudden now they've got sync issues and they're locking themselves out and so forth. So we don't run into those issues. So it's excellent in terms of that. So direct access has been with us for a little while. It's not something that's brand new. It was originally introduced as a feature of Windows Server 2008 R2. Now, direct access in Server 2008 R2 suffered from some pretty interesting challenges in that it required IPv6 to be deployed on your intranet in order to take care of, in order to take advantage of that. So out of curiosity, and I love asking this question, how many in this room have deployed IPv, or have deployed server direct access on Windows Server 2008 R2 without Forefront UAG?
Sort of?
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So I can count on one hand the number of people who have tried. I haven't run into anybody that's actually successfully implemented it. Real challenge. The concept was great. Microsoft had a great idea. However, it just functionally just wasn't feasible. You know, people, you know, deploying IPv6 on an intranet is not trivial. It takes a lot of planning. There's a lot of infrastructure components that have to be replaced. Routers, switches, IDS, IPS, logging. There's all kinds of challenges with deploying IPv6. So it's not going to happen anytime soon. And a lot of corporate networks may not happen for a long, long time, if ever. So that was the limitation of Server 2008 R2. So when Forefront UAG came out, Forefront UAG included some features and capabilities that kind of reduced the barrier to entry for some of the challenges that Server 2008 R2 included. So it removed the requirement to have IPv6 deployed on your intranet, which was huge. So people started actually deploying direct access on a regular basis with Forefront UAG. Now, the challenge there is that while Forefront UAG makes things better from an infrastructure perspective, at the same time, it makes things a little bit worse because Forefront UAG is not a trivial system to install, configure, implement, maintain, manage, monitor. It comes with its own set of challenges. It requires its own set of cows, so it adds some expense for some organizations. So while making things better, it has a tendency to make things worse. Now, when we get to Server 2012 direct access is kind of really hitting its stride. So it takes a lot of the features and capabilities that were in Forefront UAG, they're now part of the operating system. So we have a solution that is much, much easier to deploy even than Forefront UAG without the additional complexities that Forefront UAG brought. So what's new in direct access in Windows Server 2012? And I guess you could say, by extension, Server 2012 R2. All kinds of things. As I had mentioned before, I could do an entire talk on what's new in Server 2012 Direct Access. There's all kinds of things in Direct Access that make it a compelling solution. But what I want to do is I want to touch at least on some of the high points as far as what's new so that you can get an idea for some of the features and capabilities that I think are important to driving the adoption of Direct Access. So I think the biggest takeaway that you get from Server 2012 Direct Access is that the folks in the operating system teams have made this much, much easier to deploy. Direct Access in Server 2012 has a simplified deployment model. You can actually deploy Direct Access in as little as 3 mouse clicks. Just because you can doesn't mean you should, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. I'm going to demonstrate it, and then we'll talk about some of the caveats to that as well. Direct Access in Server 2012 also has a much more flexible network placement model. Forefront UAG and its predecessor, Server 2008 R2 Direct Access, both had hard requirements to be located directly on the edge of your network. They had to have public IPv4 addresses assigned to the external interface, you had to have 2 interfaces, and you had to you had to have consecutive public IPv4 addresses if you wanted to take advantage of Teredo. Now, that was a real challenge because the system also requires that it be domain joined. And so I can tell you from experience, it's a tough conversation to have with a CIO or a CTO and say, we need to put this Windows domain join Windows box directly on the internet in your organization. Now, Forefront UAG came with Forefront TMG, or Threat Management Gateway, which is an enterprise-class firewall. So we won a lot of those conversations, but it was still a challenge. In Server 2012, it supports deployment behind a NAT, and so we don't have to have that conversation anymore. You can put it behind your existing border router or edge firewall. No challenges there. Also, it supports deployment on a single network adapter. Yeah? That's correct. In Windows Server 2012, you do not have to have Forefront UAG. Correct. They don't necessarily, well, they can coexist, but they really don't know about each other. So In Server 2012, there's tremendous in performance enhancements as well. So in the simplified deployment model, you can actually use a single IPsec tunnel as long as you're using... I put an asterisk there because it doesn't support single IPsec tunnel in all deployment scenarios. But there are some deployment scenarios in which you can use a single IPsec tunnel. In UAG and then in Windows Server 2008 R2, it used two IPsec tunnels. One was called the infrastructure tunnel, and that was to allow the direct access client to talk to the domain controllers to do authentication, name resolution, and so forth. And then there was an intranet tunnel or an access tunnel, which was the second IPsec tunnel, which gave you full access to CorpNet resources. We can do that over a single tunnel in some deployment scenarios in Server 2008 or in Server 2012. Now, the performance enhancement there is that with supporting just a single tunnel, there's obviously a lot of work that has to be done to perform IPsec operations, and if you have a lot of users on your box, having two tunnels can be a challenge, but if we can cut that down to one, I've reduced my IPsec traffic by half, I can get a lot more users on the box. There's also been some improvements to IP-HTTPS. We're going to talk a little bit later about IPv6 transition protocols, and IP-HTTPS is one of them that is a protocol that had some serious performance limitations in earlier releases. We'll talk about that a little bit more later. The solution is much, much more scalable now. The previous versions pretty much had to have in a single location, and your load balancing features were somewhat limited. It was only limited to like failover clustering. Load balancing is supported out of the box with Server 2012 Direct Access, and supports geographic redundancy. So we now have in the box the ability to put multiple gateways in multiple physical locations, so I can create multiple entry points into my CorpNet. And with Windows 8 clients, the Windows 8 clients will actually intelligently select the one that's closest to them. Windows 7 clients, unfortunately, don't support that, but Windows 8 clients do. And that also brings up a kind of an overarching theme here, is that when we're talking about a lot of the new features and capabilities, most of them are only supported in Windows 8 clients. So it will support Windows 7 clients, but you get somewhat of a degraded experience, so we always recommend that you use Windows 8 clients as much as you possibly can. And then, of course, from a management perspective, monitoring, reporting, diagnostics, all much better in Server 2012 R2, and it supports PowerShell. You can do everything in PowerShell, deploy it, monitor, maintain it, manage it. Everything can be done through PowerShell. Tremendously helpful, especially when you're doing diagnostics, and on the client side, there's some great utilities that you can use there that are going to make your life a lot easier. So talking about direct access, it's important to understand that Direct Access isn't a protocol. Rather, it's a collection of technologies that are kind of assembled to build a always-on remote access solution. So we start with, of course, Windows Server 2012. It can be any edition, doesn't matter, standard or data center, really doesn't matter. On the client side, we recommend using Windows 8 Enterprise. You can use Windows 7 Enterprise or Ultimate, but again, some of the features you can't take advantage of in Windows for Windows 7. The solution relies on IPv6 for transport and IPsec for its encryption and privacy and so forth and its protection. So we're leveraging those technologies as well. We're using Active Directory and Group Policy to manage all of the settings that we deploy to the server and the clients to manage those IPsec communication. So the solution does require certificates, and I know some people cringe when they hear the word certificates. Certificates are required. A PKI is optional in Windows Server 2012 and R2. Now, I put there strongly recommended. Wearing my information security engineer hat, you can use self-signed certificates. The solution does allow to do that. The wizard will generate a self-signed cert for use for that. The self-signed certificate is weak. Self-signed certificates in my book are for test, right? I don't recommend that you go into a production environment with self-signed certificates, but you certainly can. You have that option. And we're actually going to use that in the demo, but again, you know, do as I say, not as I do. So certificates are optional. They are, however, required if you want to support Windows 7, a PKI, excuse me. So if you have Windows 7 clients and you want to connect them to a Server 2012 or Server 2012 R2 direct access server, then you must have a PKI. There's no way to get around it. They don't support using the self-signed certificates. The network location server is a component that used to be a separate component in previous releases. So Server 2008 R2, Forefront UAG Direct Access, you had to stand up a separate network location server. It's really nothing more than a web server that the client uses to, as a probe, to identify or determine whether or not it's on the internal network or the external network. So the client has to understand where it is in the world. If it's on CorpNet, I don't need my IPsec tunnels. But if I'm outside, then I need to light those tunnels up. And it uses the network location server to determine that. The network location server, as I said before, was a separate component. It is now built into the server and into the role. And so when you installed the direct access server, this component's actually installed on the server, so you don't have to worry about setting anything up there. It's nothing more than an HTTPS web server. So your client, when it lights up, is going to send a probe out to the network location server. It's going to resolve its name in DNS and make a connection. And if it makes a connection, it says, great, I'm on the CorpNet. If it can't make a connection, it says, then I must be outside, and we'll light up the tunnels, and we'll talk a little bit more in detail about that later. The direct access also includes a couple of components called DNS 6-4 and NAT 6-4. As I'd mentioned earlier, Server 2008 R2 required IPv6 to be deployed on your corporate network, on your intranet. DNS 6-4 and NAT 6-4 is what enables direct access clients now to talk to IPv4 only resources. So I don't have to deploy IPv6 on my CorpNet thanks to the DNS 6-4 and NAT 6-4 protocol translators. Another component is a component called the Name Resolution Policy Table, or NRPT. We're going to use that to provide policy-based name resolution routing. So when we're out on the internet, we're going to tell the computer, we're going to tell the laptop or the portable device, anything in this specific namespace, which is my corporate internal namespace, resolve via the DNS server that resides on the direct access server. Everything else, go directly to the DNS servers that are assigned to my network adapter. Excuse me. And last, we make use of the Windows firewall with advanced security. So we're going to take the direct access server creates IPsec connection, security connection rules. We're going to deploy those to the Windows firewall with advanced security on our clients using group policy. And I'll show you that a little bit later. Excuse me. So, direct access requires IPv6 end-to-end. Now, this is a concept that you have to make sure that you understand and grasp completely. From a client perspective, direct access is an IPv6 only solution. And that tends to scare people, but you don't have to worry about it because everything kind of just works. It's transparent to you. You don't have to understand it. But ultimately, this is important for us to understand the shortcomings and some of the limitations of the solution. So, since it requires IPv6 end-to-end, what if our client's on the public internet and it has an IPv4 address? Or what if my direct access server doesn't have an IPv6 address assigned to it? Well, obviously we understood that that's probably the vast majority of cases. So direct access includes a number of IPv6 transition technologies that we use to tunnel our IPv6 communication over the IPv4 internet. So a number of solutions or a number of technologies. The first one I want to talk about is 6-4. And the 6-4 transition technology is used anytime the client has a public IPv4 address. So if I take my laptop and I plug it straight into my cable modem and I get an IPv4, public IPv4 address from my ISP, my client will attempt to use the 6-4 adapter. The 6-4 protocol uses IP protocol 41 as its transport. So it's going to take my IPv6 communication from my client, encapsulate it in an IP packet, an IPv4 packet, using IP protocol 41. It's going to send it to the direct access server where it will be decapsulated and then dropped on my network as IPv4. Now, we don't always have a public IPv6 or IPv4 address, so that's where Teredo comes in. Teredo is used anytime my client has a private IP address. So if I'm behind a NAT, which is the vast majority of time these days, I can't use 6-4 because I don't have a public IPv4 address, so I'll use Teredo. And Teredo uses UDP for its transport. It uses protocol 3544. So if I don't have a, if I have a public IPv4 or a private IPv4 address, I'll use Teredo. The challenge with Teredo is that it requires UDP for transport, and a lot of firewalls block that. So if I have a private IP address and outbound UDP 3544 is not opened, I need another way to tunnel this traffic. Enter IP-HTTPS. So IP-HTTPS is pretty self-explanatory there. It's used anytime 6-4 and Teredo are not available to us. It's the protocol, it's the transition protocol of last resort. And basically what we're doing is we're encapsulating our IPv6 communication inside of HTTP and protecting it with SSL and TLS. And then the last protocol transition technology I want to talk about is ISOTAP. ISOTAP is used on the intranet. So the first three are actually for our clients connecting back to a corpnet. ISOTAP is used for the intranet hosts that need to initiate communication outbound to a direct access client. ISOTAP enables our intranet manage out scenarios. And so this is when I talked about bidirectional connectivity. If a direct access client is actively connected to my gateway, I, from my intranet, can initiate communication outbound to them. That might mean doing an RDP session. It may mean pushing out a script to run some software on all of my managed machines, what have you. But I can start or initiate that communication from my intranet if I'm using ISOTAP or if I have IPv6 deployed. Now, when you install Direct Access, the remote access role, it installs and configures itself as an ISOTAP router. That's not all that you need to do to take advantage of it, but ultimately those settings are kind of in the box. It does require that you make a change to DNS, so you have to actually create a DNS record called ISOTAP in your DNS zone. You need to also remove ISOTAP from the global query block list, because by default the DNS server won't, even though you create the record, the DNS server won't respond to those requests until you explicitly remove it from that list. It's a safety feature, a security feature. Now, ISOTAP is an interesting technology in that when we started deploying Direct Access many years ago, it was just kind of standard operating procedure. You know, we employed it. We did it. The documentation we were following when we were learning it said to do it, so we did it. Real world, of course, teaches us differently, and so I just want to talk a little bit about that. Today, we're recommending that users or that organizations not deploy ISOTAP, where we used to do that in the past. And the reason for that is because it enabling it causes sometimes more challenges than it solves. When you enable ISOTAP, again, you make that change in the DNS, every host in your environment that can resolve that record to an IPv4 address will initiate an ISOTAP tunnel adapter. So you could have potentially tens, thousands, or tens of thousands of hosts on your network now that all speak IPv6. That can cause some real challenges. There's also some brokenness that can come with that as well. Fundamentally, I have a real problem with ISOTAP because ISOTAP flips the OSI model upside down. Lower layer protocols depend entirely on upper layer protocols. And so what that means is that if my DNS server, if my client can't resolve a host name correctly, it can't route. And to me, that's just flat wrong. That's a real challenge. There's also a lack of any real enterprise monitoring and management tools for ISOTAP. If you're using ISOTAP in your environment, your network people are going to want to know about this service and that it's, you know, that it's on and it's running and it's working. Today, when we deploy ISOTAP, often the only way we know it's not working is when somebody starts complaining. So some real challenges there. So the network guys kind of don't like that. So the answer, of course, is to deploy IPv6. So it's kind of a circular logic here. I know we say, hey, you know, it's a real challenge. And again, I'm with you here. IPv6 is not going to be deployed on an intranet overnight, and probably not going to be deployed because we want to build in a really cool remote access solution. I think there's a lot more planning that has to take place for that. So there are some alternatives, though, thankfully. You can restrict ISOTAP to very specific hosts. So oftentimes in an environment, Not every machine in your organization needs to initiate communication outbound to direct access clients. Often it's just a handful of stations. It's your systems administrators. It's your help desk personnel. Sometimes it's even only one desk. You know, sometimes a lot of organizations will use like an admin workstation, and only that one really needs it. So what we have found is it's a much better alternative to light up Isotap for only those hosts who need it, and then leave it off for everybody else. And there's a couple of ways to do that. You can do that through group policy, which is a real quick and easy way. There's some documentation on the internet about that. You can use PowerShell, so set NetIsotap configuration, dash router, and then the name or the IP address that's assigned to the internal network interface of your direct access server, and that will work for that individual host. You can use NetSH too if you're old school. So do it with PowerShell. That's how all the cool kids are doing it. You can use host file. So I've actually done this before. I don't recommend it. I think I'm going to take this off the slide just because, you know, putting entries in host files is very old school, and that's kind of Unix-like. So don't do that. So this is interesting. So we have this conversation about direct access, how great it is. It's great for your managed clients. It works great, easy to use. The administrators get some benefits from that. But unfortunately, it does come with some limitations, and I would obviously be doing you a disservice if I didn't tell you about those. So some of the limitations really are around the clients and supported clients. So to take advantage of direct access, you must have Windows 8 Enterprise or Windows 7 Enterprise or Windows 7 Ultimate. So not professional, not home edition for any of the other systems. So no XP, no Vista, or anything like that. Windows 8 Enterprise, Windows 7 Enterprise, Windows 7 Ultimate. Those three SKUs only are supported for direct access on Windows Server 2008 R2 with Forefront UAG or on Server 2012 and 2012 R2. Those systems also must be domain joined as well because we're using Active Directory and group policy to manage the IPsec settings on the client and on the server. So non-supported clients, intuitively, of course, Windows 8 Professional, Windows Vista, Windows XP, anything that's non-domain joined. Your Surface RT won't work. Your Surface Pro will not work out of the box because it's running Professional Edition. Although you can, if you can get Enterprise Edition running on that, it certainly works with direct access, so that's always good. And I just bought my Surface Pro this week, so I'm going to be taking that home, and you can bet that one's going to have direct access on it probably on Saturday afternoon. Yep. So there's also some client compatibility issues as well, and it's important to talk about those. Direct access communication, as I'd mentioned before, is IPv6 only. So any application that has protocols that use embedded IPv4 addresses, SIP, FTP, Citrix, ICA, I think, actually communicates with, or at least used to, with IPv4. There's a number of applications that will not work or on a direct access client. So be aware of that. It's not a kind of, it's not a utopia here. There are some applications that don't work. Any applications with hard-coded IPv4 addresses, not that a developer would ever hard-code an IPv4 address into compiled code, but, you know, conceptually that could happen. Not that I haven't seen that before. IP protocol communication, so it's basically TCP UDP. So things like ICMP don't work over that. TCP, UDP, ICMP work. IP protocol doesn't work. So I had a customer one time over the direct access communication channel wanted to PPTP into a server in their lab or something like that, and it was failing. So anyway, that uses IP and GRE and that stuff. So obviously those protocols don't work. So there are some limitations there with regards to communication. So how does direct access work? Well, let's walk through the scenario of the client from the client side. Let's say we have a direct access configured client. It's sitting on our intranet. The client assumes, when you start it up, it assumes that it is not connected to the intranet. Okay? And so the first thing it's going to want to do is look for that network location server, as I'd mentioned before. It's going to send out an HTTP probe. It's going to resolve a host name to an IP. If that fails, obviously that's not going to work, but if it does, it's going to attempt to communicate with that. It's going to expect to get a response, and if it does, the domain Windows Firewall with Advanced Security Profile will be activated. Once that happens, the name resolution policy table will be disabled. And so basically, it just functions as if it's connected on the local internet. No direct access IPsec tunnels are going to be brought up. And all communication just goes straight through the adapter. Everybody's happy. So if I were to take this same client and go out to the internet, so again, once I light it up, the client says, oh, I'm not connected to the internet. I'm going to look for the network location server. It's not going to connect. Now, the name resolution policy table is configured as such that it never uses, or that it always attempts to use the DNS server configured on its adapter to try and resolve that name. So if it's outside the walls of your corporate network, it can't resolve that internal name, because the only place it could resolve would be internally. Okay? So it's not going to be able to connect to the network location server. The public or the private Windows firewall profile is going to come up, and that's going to be activated. When that happens, the name resolution policy table also comes up. And the name resolution policy table is configured to say, my internal namespace, corp.example.com, are resolved by DNS server, a very specific DNS server that is on the other side of the IPsec tunnel. Everything else goes on, every other name resolution request goes on the DNS server configured on my network adapter. So as soon as it says, okay, great, name resolution policy table is enabled, and I need to find a domain controller, the network, the Windows firewall is going to look at that traffic and say, oh, that destination, that DNS server you're looking for, is on the other side of an IPsec tunnel that I need to bring up. And once it does that, then the IPsec tunnels come up. I have now CorpNet connectivity, and at that point, I basically have direct access communication. I have access to my corporate network over those IPsec tunnels. So let's talk a little bit about implementing direct access. It's not on paper, it's not a trivial thing. There's a lot of planning, obviously, that has to take place. But in a simplified deployment scenario, you're going to see that it is indeed quite simple. So it's as simple as obviously installing Server 2012, joining it to the domain, and installing the remote access feature. So it's just a feature of Windows Server 2012. You can do this via the GUI. I like to do it via PowerShell because it's quick and easy. I'll demonstrate both. There is the command line, install Windows feature remote access, include management tools, and restart if necessary. Once you've done that and the server comes back up, or the services come back up, you can configure remote access. And there's a couple of different ways to do this. There's a simplified deployment model, and then the complex deployment model. I'm going to demonstrate here the simplified deployment model just to demonstrate the kind of the user experience. The simplified deployment model works anytime you have Windows 8 clients only, anytime you don't have a requirement to do a strong authentication or two-factor authentication, anytime you are deployed either, you can actually do it on the edge, but most of the time it's done, supported in single network adapter scenarios where you have deployed it behind a border router or edge firewall performing NAT. Complex deployments are required anytime you want to support Windows 7 clients. Anytime you want to do any sort of multi-site networking, so if I want to have multiple entry points, I have to use the complex deployment model. If I want to do network load balancing, if I want to use my own PKI, which again I recommend, so we won't be able to demonstrate that. Unfortunately, that would be another session, but ultimately I'll show you where you can do that in the tools. So let's get on to a demonstration. We're going to light up direct access right here on my laptop. And so actually, let me do this. So I have on my Windows 8 laptop, I've got a Hyper-V environment with a bunch of virtual machines. And this is my direct access server. So I've already installed I've already installed Server 2012 R2, or always Server 2012, excuse me. I've joined it to the domain. Now I'm actually just going to install the remote access role. So I've not done anything other than just join it to my domain. Using the GUI, if you just go to Manage and choose Add Roles and Features, choose Next. Role-based is fine. Next. And here, what you need to do is select the remote access role. It's going to ask you to install, of course, the supporting role services and features and whatnot, so we'll select that option. Choose Next. Again, we don't need any additional services here or any features, so we can choose Next. and we'll next one more time. I don't need routing. Again, just the defaults here. Literally, you can go next through this. Here's the web server. So the web server components are required, again, for the network location server. So if you're wondering why we're installing a web server, it is for a specific purpose. So make sure. And you can select restart, and you can choose install, and you're off to the races. I obviously do these quite often, and so I actually prefer to do this using PowerShell, again, because it's really quick and simple, and you can do this remotely if you need. So install Windows feature, the role is remote access. We will include the management tools. And I like to add restart. I'll share with you from personal experience, sometimes it restarts, sometimes it doesn't want it. So we'll see. This one has not required a restart, and it looks like I typoed somewhere. What's that? Oh, there it is. Did you get that right? I wish it did tab autocomplete on the role. That way I know I would never have to misspell it. There we go. Yeah, if they add tab autocomplete to the role, that would make my life a lot easier because that's generally where I miss. So it's going to take a minute to install this role. Just about done, it looks like. And then once we get the role installed, I don't think it'll require a restart. It hasn't in all the times I practiced this demo. Once the role is fully installed, then what we're going to do is we're going to go into the management console, and we'll actually finish the configuration there. So this is basically just the foundation of installing Direct Access Server. So outstanding. So the power of snapshots. I've probably done this 3 or 4 times this week already, so I'm glad it didn't behave any differently than it had. So at this point, we're done. We can come back into the server manager. And of course, the server manager has to be refreshed. It doesn't know that we installed a role under the covers there, so we'll refresh this, and this generally takes a few refreshes. If you're type A, you can just click on this continuously if you like. For those of you who like to push the button at the stop, at the crosswalk, until it turns green. There we go. So it's refreshed, and then you'll see here that we have a little notification here that if we click on this, you'll see that there are some post-deployment configuration that has to be done. Again, we just installed the role. Now we actually need to configure it. So I'm going to select the Getting Started wizard, and this is the simplified deployment scenario. If I needed to support anything as a part of the complex deployment scenario, Windows 7, PKI, multi-site, load balancing, multi-factor authentication, anything that required that, I would actually have to go into the remote access management console and do it from there. But here we're just going to deploy a simple deployment. We have a Windows 8 client, so we'll go ahead and just click on this link, and we'll actually walk through this deployment scenario here. So the deployment wizard comes up, and we have a couple of options here. So we can deploy both Direct Access and VPN, and that's the recommended deployment scenario. Now, you might say, hey, Direct Access is awesome. Why would I ever want VPN? Well, we do have to support other clients often than Windows 8 and Windows 7 Enterprise or Ultimate. So if you have Vista, XP, what have you in your environment, if you want to provide support for other devices, maybe people's home machines and things like that, you're going to need a VPN, right? It's probably not going to completely supplant a VPN in your environment. However, you can use this one system as your only remote access solution because it does support coexisting VPN and remote direct access on the same device. We're going to deploy direct access only just for our purposes here. And so the wizard's going to check prerequisites, and it's going to ask me just a couple of questions. This first question is about where I'm going to put the direct access server. Where does the direct access server reside in my network? And I have a couple of options. Edge, behind an edge device with 2 network adapters, behind an edge device with just a single network adapter. Now, this wizard is also intelligent. If So my server here has two network adapters, and I have a public IPv4 address assigned to the external network interface. So it recognizes that and says, okay, edge is an option. If I had two network adapters and they both had private IP addresses on it, the edge option would be grayed, or excuse me, the edge would be grayed out. I would still have the option to place it behind an edge device with two network adapters, because it would know intuitively, I don't have a public IPv4 address, I can't be directly on the edge. So it's nice, it's difficult to kind of screw this up, but ultimately make sure that this matches your current network topology. I'm going to deploy it directly on the edge, so I'll choose edge. And then here we're going to specify the name that the clients use to connect to my direct access server. And in this case, I'm just going to use da.richardhicks.com. And this, it's important that this name be in your public DNS, and then it resolve to the external IPv4 address of your direct access server. If your direct access server is not directly on the internet, then it needs to resolve to the external address, IPv4 address, of your border router or edge firewall that's performing NAT. Then you need to have the NAT statement and the access rules that allow that traffic to be directed into the direct access server. So we'll use this. Choose next. And at this point, if I click finish, it will actually deploy direct access for me. However, I recommend that you don't do that, and there's also an important reason I can't do it for the demo, and I'll show you that here. So it says click here to edit the wizard settings. The wizard has done a ton of things behind the scenes that we don't see, but if I click here, I can actually see what it's doing. And so basically what it's going to do is it's going to allow me to review all of the settings. So here's the GPO settings. It's created in my lab, and so here's the direct access server GPO name and the client. So there's a set of policies that go out to the direct access servers as well as the direct access clients. The client targeting is where I have a challenge here in my lab. So if I see remote clients, it's going to lab/domain computers. If I click on change, you'll see the problem here is that enable direct access for mobile computers only is checked. Unfortunately, in my lab here, I'm just using Hyper-V, so it's not a mobile device. This option enables a group policy WMI filter to look for very specific hardware that identifies itself as being mobile. And so if I did this in this lab, it wouldn't work. So if I uncheck this, now it's going to give me a warning that says, hey, you're going to deploy direct access to every computer in your domain, essentially. Obviously, that's a bad thing, too. So what I have done is I have actually created a group in Active Directory and added the computer account of my client workstation to that group, and so I'm going to specify that group. And this is, and I'm doing this for the lab, but honestly, this is a best practice. It's not a good idea to bomb direct access out to every computer in your organization. It's a much better way to do this if you target it specifically at an individual group. So I always recommend creating a group, putting those machines in there, and explicitly deploying them. So if I choose next, this is somewhat unintuitive here, and you'll have to just learn from my experience. But here it looks like I need to put something. It doesn't really give you an indication of what that might be. Again, take my word for it from experience. You don't have to put anything here. The wizard actually populates that in the background. Unintuitively, you do need to put something here for help desk mail address. And the reason we need something here, anything, is because on the client side, there's a utility called the Direct Access Connectivity Assistant. And it has the ability to collect log information. The log button is grayed out if I don't put an email address in here. So even if I have no intention of emailing it, I still have to have an email here so that I can get that button to light up so that I can use that on the client side. We can rename this. I'm just going to leave this as workplace connection. Really doesn't matter. So we'll choose finish. And at this point, I've made the changes that I really need for my lab. And so we can choose OK and finish. And at this point now, the wizard's going to build these group policy objects. It's going to send them to Active Directory. And implicit in that, by the way, is that I have permission to write group policy objects into Active Directory. If you don't have that permission, you do have the ability to export there. Export those objects, send those to your AD administrators, and have them deploy them appropriately in Active Directory. So we'll choose close. And at this point, the remote access management console is going to launch. So that window goes away. The remote access management console is going to come up. And the first thing you'll see is that the configuration status is unavailable. And the reason for that is because the configuration comes from Active Directory. So we just push those objects out to group policy objects out to Active Directory. There's going to be a period of time before we can get that back, that information back via GPOs, get it installed on the Direct Access server. So it takes, in my lab here, obviously I just have the two or three machines, so obviously that's not a big deal. In some environments with very large Active Directories, this can take a period of time. So if you have a huge environment, you're doing this in production, and it's like 10, 15 minutes, depending on your replication topology and where you are. Be patient. This can take a period of time. Fortunately enough for me, it should only take a couple of refreshes, and I've got that. So I hit refresh. My configuration has been distributed successfully. Now what you'll see is an operation status. So I have all these components. It's going to spin all of these services up, and then it's going to report on their status. You're going to see a couple of blue ones here. The reason for that is because they've just come up. They're available, but we don't have all the information. So if you just hit refresh once or twice more, ultimately, if everything's gone correctly, you should see lots of green checkboxes here. Green is good, and so we're good to go. So at this point, I'm actually done with the DA server configuration, and I can go over to my client. So let's jump over to the client. And just to demonstrate, so this client has two network adapters, and the reason it has that is because I need to be able to simulate taking the client outside of the corporate network. So it has two network interfaces. The public one's been disabled for right now, so just the private one is up. But if you'll see here, on this client, I'm on the internal network. I can get to my application server via its single label host name without issue. I can get to my map drives here, so I have a data drive that's been mapped. And I can get to my data and applications quickly and easily. I can, let's see here. We can ping our domain controller. We're on the corpnet, everything's working fine. So let's go ahead and take this thing as an exercise out to the internet. So I'm gonna disable the private interface. I'm gonna light up this public interface. And basically what I have simulated here is taking my laptop, going across the street to the Starbucks, or maybe going home and sitting on my couch and opening this up. And now I'm on the public internet. Okay, I have a, let's take a look at this. So you'll see here that I have a public IPv4 address. And at this point, you look at this, okay, well, how do I even know that I'm connected? Well, if I hit window key I, come over here to network, you'll see that I don't have anything. Let's see, do that again. All right. Okay, so the service is not running, so this is a somewhat common issue. So it's basically the network connectivity assistant hasn't started. So we'll go to the network connectivity assistant. So network connectivity assistant is what's going to report on the status of that direct access connection. And every once in a while, you have to get out and push with this one. So for whatever reason, didn't want to start. You know what? Thank you. Group policy. See what happens when I do this. See what happens when I do this like 8 times before this. I go so fast, I forget a step. Thank you. That was a fail. I did forget that. Thank you. So we forgot to update group policy. Correct. Because that machine was already logged on, and I had just did it mere minutes after that. So it hadn't had a chance to update its policy. So we will update our group policy. Now this will work. So at this point, completed successfully. So we can actually verify that. Didn't look like it. Try that again. I swear you could rehearse these demos 100 times. They'll work every time. You get in front of a crowd, something will go wrong. Operator error on my fault, though. So let's make sure we have the correct policy. So that's GP result. And I'm not on the administrator. Where is that? Come on. No, it's not going to let me keep that open. Okay. There we go. And I usually always open it as administrator because invariably I need to do something with that. There we go. So we want to make sure that we have the applied policy as the direct access client settings. Now, if we take this outside, we should be good to go. Let's try this again. Great. So window key I will come over to our network, and we see workplace connection. It's connecting. If I right-click and choose view connection properties, as this is starting to come up, you may see a bit of a delay, but ultimately, if everything's successful, should say you are connected remotely. So that's helpful. It's a tremendously helpful, a nice visual cue that you are connected. Here's that collect logs buttons that I mentioned earlier. If you leave that email address out of there, this button doesn't show up, and you can't use it. It's kind of foolish, but such is life. So let's go back and see if we can get to our resources. So again, we have a public IPv4 address. We're on the public internet. And we can still get to our application server by its single label hostname, right? I can still get to my direct access or to my share using my map drive. I didn't have to do anything different. It doesn't fail, and then I have to figure out, oh, yeah, I forgot to start the VPN up. It's just there. It just works. It's awesome. Direct access is really, really wonderful. And then, of course, just under the hood, we were talking about the IPv6 to IPv4 translation. Interesting thing here. Let's go ahead and ping my domain controller. And you'll notice something a little different now. When I ping my domain controller, it resolves it only to an IPv6 address. Now, when you're looking at this, this is an IPv6 address that I didn't have to configure. I didn't have to go in and set up IPv6 prefixes and figure all the IPv6 stuff out. Direct Access does this for me, and so this is tremendously helpful. This is a synthetic address, by the way. This is an address that was assigned to me or to the domain controller using the NAT64 service, and then NAT64 resolves it, DNS64 resolves it to this IP address when I ask for that name. So if you're looking at this very carefully, if anybody in the audience speak hex, you'll see that right there in hex is the IPv4 address of my DNS, or my domain controller. So that's actually 172.16.1.200 in hex. So that's how the DNS or the NAT64 service maps that. So when I make a request for this, I'm sending this IPv4 address, the NAT64 service knows how to map that to the correct IPv4 resource internally. So that's kind of the secret sauce behind that. So so anyway, that is direct access. It you know, as you saw, much easier, certainly, if anybody has any experience with Forefront UAG direct access. Takes a little bit less time to do that, a little less moving parts, but it is an excellent solution. It does work quite well. So let's go, and I want to kind of follow up with this just last few minutes and talk about some of the security considerations around direct access. I throw the slide in here because, again, I think anytime you're talking about a remote access solution, you should talk about security. That's important to us. A lot of what we're going to talk about in this slide really applies to any sort of remote access, whether it's direct access or VPN. But from a security perspective, of course, authentication is king. Direct access is fully authenticated. Those IPsec tunnels are authenticated at the machine level and at the user level. So they are a very secure tunnels. I always talk about password policy. So anytime you have remote access users, you probably want to enforce long, complex password for them. You'd like to do that, hopefully using complex password policies as a part of Server 2012. If you don't have those domain controllers, you can, I think, do that with Server 2008 R2. But I think it's real clunky. But ultimately, review your password policy when you have remote users. Smart cards are obviously important. Direct Access does support the use of smart cards, and it also has a feature that allows you to do use the TPM to do what's an embedded smart card or a virtual smart card. So the actual smart card doesn't even have to be a reader. It actually is just in the TPM in your laptop, and the laptop itself then becomes the second factor. So that's a great way to do it, and I think that's obviously the way Microsoft does that. It does support dynamic passwords, so you can integrate a two-factor authentication solution with Direct Access. So if you're using RSA, if you're using somebody else's dynamic password solution that's radius-based or something, we have support for that as well. From the endpoint perspective, again, any mobile device should have its BitLocker turned on, right? Use whole disk encryption. If it's not BitLocker, use something. Any mobile device that I think needs to have that capability. Enable the boot pin. I think that's another a way to mitigate the risk of mobile devices. Again, a lot of the concerns comes around, well, the laptop has direct access to the internet all the time, or anytime it has access to the internet, it has access to my corporate network, and there are some concerns with that. So that's what we're really talking about addressing and mitigating here. Antivirus solutions, of course. Sometimes, AV solutions can be the punching bag of the security world because they're not effective all the time, but that doesn't mean that they are not still a good tool to use and to leverage in our defense in depth strategy, so make sure those are on. The nice thing about with Direct Access is that you have the ability to monitor and report on that and make sure that they are up to date, so you have an additional line of defense there. Excuse me. From an infrastructure perspective, Direct Access does support NAP integration. So if you have deployed NAP, you can leverage that to do endpoint policy enforcement. So if somebody's turned off, the firewall, Direct Access doesn't work. So you don't have to worry about people turning off the firewall on you. But if they've disabled AV or they're not fully patched or up to date or compliant in some other fashion, you can integrate NAP with Direct Access. There are also some good remote content filtering solutions on the market. So anytime you have a device that has access to the corporate network and the public internet at the same time, probably a good idea to make sure they're not going to the bad sites, either on purpose or by accident. So there are some good solutions that you can leverage out there that do remote content filtering as well. Also, it's important to understand that we can terminate a Direct Access client at any time by disabling their account in Active Directory. So your users, of course, will always tell you the instant they lose their laptop, so you don't have anything to worry about. Right. Anyway, once you do find out that a Direct Access-enabled device has been lost or stolen, disable their computer account. That will prevent them from accessing. If they are still connected proactively, so when I go and delete their computer account, if they had a Direct Access session established, it will not terminate that session. There's a little bit of extra work you have to do. But ultimately, you do have some options there. So that kind of wraps up the session. Once again, I thank everybody for coming. I'd love to take questions. We still have time in the session. Of course, there's no other session after this. We don't have to worry about getting out of anybody's way. But I'm all over the internet. I'd love it if you connected with me on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, what have you. You can scan the QR code or go to richardhicks.com/connect. If you want to keep in touch with me, that's great. I have a couple of giveaways here, too, so before everybody runs off, I want to do a couple of things here. I have a book by my good friend Ben Ari, who is the author of this fantastic book on Windows Server 2012 Unified Remote Access, and I'm going to give that away to the first person who will bring me one of the squishy balls from the Iron Networks booth. So if anybody visited the Iron Networks booth and has one of their stress balls, this book is yours. So first one to do that. So come on down. Yes. And then I also have some train signal vouchers for, let's see, what is it good for? 30 days of free training on train signal. For those of you that want to know more about Direct Access, I did a video training series for Direct Access on Server 2012 for train signal. So if you're interested in that, check it out. if you can do it in under 30 days, you can do that for free. But I covered all the deployment scenarios in detail, walked through demonstrations. And so if you want to look at that, take a look, and you can learn all that there. But again, connect with me on the internet. I'd be happy to answer any questions and so forth. But for those of you that are leaving, have a great time. Thank you for coming, and I appreciate it.